This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm bringing you the show today from Edstone, England. Watching world events from the standpoint of Bible prophecy is highly instructive. It brings sense and perspective to seemingly senseless and random events. It's also very exciting. Watching events sometimes very precisely follow the prophecies of the Bible and realizing these events aren't just random occurrences, but that God is involved. He's orchestrating things. That's very exciting. In our first segment today, we're going to look at one of those prophecies. It's a broad trend we see developing, an emerging world order in the age of President Donald Trump. It involves three other nations, and these nations are developing relationships that are specifically prophesied in the book of Isaiah. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this remarkable development. On Tuesday, President Trump unveiled a new strategy for how America will deal with the situation in Afghanistan. This is a long-standing war America has been involved in here, and he's committing America to ramping up its presence in this country in an effort to win this conflict. Well, is this really going to lead to an American victory in this theater of war? We're going to talk with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about this. In our third segment, there are a lot of people say the Bible is just a collection of myths and legends, and one of the best known among the Bible's stories is that of the Tower of Babel, where people built a tower to reach heaven, and then God stopped the project by confounding people's languages. Well, did this really happen? We're going to talk with trumpet writer Chris Eames about the fact that it's not just a story in the Bible. It's actually a story that occurs in cultures all over the world. And that lends credence to the idea that all these different cultures actually sprang from a common experience, that the Bible's Tower of Babel account, it's more than just a fanciful Bible story. And I'll finish off the program today by talking about how important it is that we civilize our children. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. We live in a world of headlines. There are always plenty of splashy items that attract media attention. What gets lost, though, is a tracking of trends, the broad trends that show how our world is changing. Here's a recent statement from a senior economics analyst at Malden Economics, and he's talking about an important trend in today's world. He wrote, "Globalization 2.0 has some important investment implications. Instead of one big worldwide sort of free trade zone, we will have two trading blocks. They will be the United States and everyone else." Two trading blocks, the United States and everyone else. If you've followed the trumpet for any length of time, that is a tremendous statement, basically talking about the United States being isolated from the rest of the world in trade. That's something that Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied decades ago. It's not necessarily something that has made the splashy single headline just yet, but if you're alert to what's happening here, you're seeing it develop right before your eyes. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So you're working on an article for the next print edition of The Trumpet, basically exposing this trend. And there were a few elements of developments that we've seen in the world today that you kind of put together and recognized. We're talking about a fulfillment of a pretty specific Bible prophecy here, and we're seeing this take place before our eyes. So let's just go ahead and talk about these. First of all, the fact that, and this goes back several months now, that China has really begun to aggressively position itself as the successor to the United States as the leader of trade in the world, the leading economic nation in the world. Talk about that a little bit.
Right, so of the three things that I was kind of tracking in this article, this is probably the biggest developed and the best known of the three. I think there have been a whole ton of articles about this over the last few months. We've had some even in the Trumpet magazine where trade between Europe and China, and especially Germany and China, has been increasing. And then that's been going on for the past, say, 3-4 years. And then since Donald Trump was elected as U.S. president, Europe has been looking for an alternative partner, and China has been kind of doing everything it can to say, hey, look at me, I'm a great alternative to the United States for you guys. And so you see it. So President Trump puts out some kind of protectionist type statements. Well, then the Chinese president travels to Davos, as he did several months ago, and talks about how dreadful protectionism and kind of puts himself forward as the leader of free trade. Then you see, say, the Paris Climate Change Agreements, and Mr. Trump pulls out of that. And so China goes to Europe and the two of them get together and they sign their first ever agreement on climate change between the two of them. Now, the reality of these situations are quite different, both on, say, free trade and how free trade America is, or how environmentally friendly America versus China is. But the important point, as far as this subject is concerned, is that China is there trying to portray itself as the alternative leader of America, and it's working hard to forge a partnership with Europe. There's also been some friction in that partnership over the last few months because Europe doesn't see China as the successor to America. Europe sees Europe as the successor to America. So there is some friction, and I would expect some friction to continue as the two kind of, you know, that China wants Europe to be the junior partner, Europe wants China to be the junior mm-hmm. partner. So there's still friction, but there is a common desire for a partnership there. And they are working, despite that friction, towards this partnership in some very important ways. I mean, we've got an article that we just linked to on our website just today talking about the massive infrastructure spending that China's making in Central Asia. Germany has become an important partner in this, building just the solid infrastructure of trade links between the two. And so it's a partnership that's taking on increasing importance in the world.
Yeah, and not just do they have the desire for a partnership between them, but they're also united in their desire to undermine the United States as the preeminent power trade-wise. So that's the first of those three trends that you're looking at. The second is the emergence of Japan as a partner with the European Union.
That's right. And we talked about this on this show, especially that big trade deal that Europe and Japan signed. It's kind of more in outlines, an agreement in principle with the broad outlines. And then they've still got to work out the details. But what they're proposing is a massive free trade area here. I mean, obviously, the European Union itself is a massive free trade zone. You've got several of the G7 economies within Europe, you know, Germany, obviously, but France, Italy, Spain's a big economy as well. And then Japan is just an economic giant, too. And so with these coming together, you don't just have something that affects Europe and Japan. You have something with global implications, a trade zone that rivals NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Area, in size. You have a trade zone that can start setting rules that the whole world is going to end up having to follow, because it's, you know, a lot of countries are going to be exporting some of their products to Europe or Japan. And so as they start to follow the rules for Europe or Japan, they'll have to, you know, they'll apply that across their whole supply chain. Mm-hmm. Similar to the California effect you get in the United States, where California passes some new law and then suddenly every cell phone sold in the United States or even the whole world has on the box, this device is known to the state of California to cause cancer. You have the same effect worldwide with this kind of trade zone. Mm-hmm. So it's something that would have a massive effect for everyone.
So Europe is strengthening its ties with China. Here, just last month at the G20 summit, it outlined the future agreement that it plans to make with Japan. Looking at this, say, with historical animosity between China and Japan, you would think that Europe would have to choose but this third trend that you're looking at is the increasing level of collusion between these two giants of Asia. And this is a really critical prophetic trend, the fact that we're actually seeing a certain amount of strengthening ties between these two.
That's right. This is probably the newest of these trends that we've been talking about. But at that same G20 summit where you saw Europe and Japan move closer together, the Japanese prime minister had a fairly lengthy discussion with the Chinese president. And that's one, I don't think they talked for about 10 months ahead of then. But before that meeting, there was a lot of intensive officials cooperating. And then right after that, the Japanese prime minister came out with a very surprising announcement. He was going to join China's One Belt, One Road project, this massive infrastructure project that is all about spreading Chinese power and building these trade links. And Japan is on board with that. That surprised a lot of people. A lot of traditional enemies of China have opposed that project. Even now, you've got India in a very tense situation between India and China, and people have thought that part of the thinking behind, or part of the situation behind the tenseness that you have got on the border between the two, is China trying to get back at India for India's refusal to get on board with this project and to back this project. Japan's now on board with that, and so you're seeing just the start of what looks like a rapprochement between these two countries.
So looking at this in the broad outline, and what, say, that quote that I read from the Malden economics analyst, we're talking about China, Japan, and the European Union all strengthening their relationships with one another, particularly their trade relationships. And it seems in a pretty stark the purpose for it is to undermine the United States, or to basically build bridges that the United States doesn't have access to, and to freeze the United States out. Looking at it from that standpoint, you can't help but think back to what Herbert W. Armstrong talked about some years ago, and more recently, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury talked about back in 2010. Maybe you can just fill us in on that.
Right. And this is what I think really just makes this news story and these particular countries jump off the page. Because in 2010, Mr. Fleury wrote about a scripture in Isaiah chapter 23. And this talks about a mart of nations. The emphasis in there is overwhelmingly on trade. It talks about merchants. It talks about merchant ships traveling over oceans. So we're talking about a large scale trading network. And what's most remarkable here is that passage draws attention to three nations. And Mr. Fleury spoke about these three nations. He wrote about them in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. And those three powers are this European power and China and Japan.
I mean, this is what he talked about. And at the time that he wrote this, 2010, there was really no evidence of any kind of relationship developing between China and Japan. And it was quite tenuous between the European Union and either of those countries.
Yeah, there was nothing. And I don't think I don't recall anyone else saying, watch this. I don't think, it wasn't on anybody's radar at the time. And then, since then, I kind of remember, say, 2013, 2014, getting excited about this as you watch Germany and China build a stronger relationship. And since then, Angela Merkel she's visited China more times than just about any other non-EU country. People started talking about a special relationship between Germany and China. So back, say, two, 3 years ago, you did see part of this coming together. And now it just feels like suddenly you've got this full picture. Exactly the same three countries singled out here as being the leading members of this global anti-US trade bloc are exactly the same three members that you see drawing closer together in our news headlines right now. And it's just the detail of this prophecy being fulfilled. I don't want to say surprising. I mean, we don't want to be so surprised when the Bible proves accurate.
But this is what gets us excited. This is why we do what we do, and when we see these things, why we watch the world events. And why when we see these things happening, we really do get excited.
It's a great example of just the relevance of the Bible to everyday news. I mean, I don't know anybody else who would have forecast these particular three powers coming together. And again, it's not just in any kind of alliance. It's particularly a trade alliance. And the Bible makes that very clear there. Without that, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there are some trends that we can watch and we can know what's coming from history. This particular one, though, I don't know how you would make that forecast apart from that particular scripture in the Bible.
So if somebody wants to learn more about this, what would be a good resource to go to? You obviously have your article coming up. This is going to be, it's slated for the next print edition of The Trumpet. That might be a few weeks away before it appears on the magazine, on the website. If somebody wanted to read more about it today, where would they go?
Well, in terms of maybe some of the recent news, Mr. Brad McDonald had an article in an earlier trumpet called called Trade Wars Have Begun, and that summarizes a lot of the prophecy. But really, the place to go to get a lot of this in detail is that booklet that Mr. Flory wrote about this starting in 2010, Isaiah's End Time Vision. I mean, there's a whole call-out section there proving the identity of Kittim, for example, going through proving who these nations refer to. You don't have to take our word for it. And then also just... proving going through what is at stake here. And then also, the clue is in the title, and so Isaiah's End Time Vision. It also goes through just the hope that's behind this. Because this is, like I said, this is a great way of proving this particular story, the relevance of the Bible to everyday news. Mm-hmm. But then, once you've proven that, what does that say about the future? What does that say about the immediate future, but also 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now? And Isaiah's End Time Vision, that booklet is a great place to start for getting those answers as well.
Outstanding. We appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this developing Mart of Nations prophesied in Isaiah 23 between the European Union and China and Japan. Keep your eyes on thetrumpet.com. Richard's working on an article that will appear in the coming print edition of The Trumpet magazine. It'll appear on the website before people receive it in their mailbox. But we look forward to that. And thanks for your time, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of The Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
On Tuesday, President Trump unveiled a new strategy for how America is going to deal with its war in Afghanistan. He's committed America to ramping up its presence in this country. This is a very difficult theater of war, but he wants to win this war. It's been going on for a long time. Now, is this strategy that he unveiled going to lead to victory, an American victory in Afghanistan? We have trumpet writer Brent Noctegal here to talk about this. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So why don't you start by just giving us kind of a summary of the speech, basically what President Trump outlined for what America is going to do here?
Yeah, the speech, it was his first address to the nation in the past 6 months. And he was addressing a number of military officials. He's at a base in the United States. And he started out talking about the difficult situation the United States finds itself in right now domestically. And he laid out gave the case to the people there and the American public that it's unfair on the soldiers that are fighting all throughout the world on behalf of the United States to come home to a nation that's divided amongst itself, which I thought was really just a really interesting beginning. But then he proceeded for the next 20 minutes to lay out the strategy as he sees it. This is a strategy that he has set about, one that he announced that there was going to be a policy change, even going back about 6 months. And his generals have come together formulated a policy for Afghanistan. Clearly, the president, as well as the American people, were not happy with the fruits of the Afghan war for the past 15, 16 years. People haven't seen many fruits of it. And so Mr. Trump has decided to change the policy in the following ways. First, he said that there will be no more nation building. This is not something that the United States is going to get involved in. What he means by that is changing basically exporting democracy to different theaters, different nations around the world that aren't used to it. We've tried to do this under President Bush, different U.S., different Middle Eastern countries, take over their government, or at least remove the dictator or the leadership and set up a new democracy, and then help them establish that style of governance in their country. He said, that's it. We're not doing that anymore. We are simply there to get the terrorists. We are going to kill the terrorists, and then we're going to be gone, basically. So he said this.
So narrowing the scope of what we were trying to accomplish there. Essentially, this is a hard sell to Americans. Well, the war that's been going on for, what has it been, 16 years? Longest running war that America has ever been involved in. And essentially what he's saying is that the efforts that we have put into trying to rebuild Afghanistan have not succeeded, and we basically need to take that off the table in terms of the mandate of our mission there.
Right. That obviously hasn't worked. He is still going to work with the Afghani army, military, and trying to help them create the stability needed for them to rule themselves and decide how they will rule themselves at that point. But yeah, the United States, I forget the exact percentage right now, but it's the favorability for this war, I think it's in about 20 or 30%. Most of the United States doesn't want to be a part of it, the populace. And he acknowledged that right at the beginning. He said nearly 16 years after the September 11th attacks, after the extraordinary sacrifice of blood and treasure, the American people are wary of war without victory. Nowhere is this more evident than with the war in Afghanistan, the longest war in America's history, 17 years. I share the American people's frustration. And that is sincere. He does. He wants to be a winner, and it's very difficult for him to see a way out. So, number one, we're going just after the terrorists. We're not going to do any nation building, that type of thing, anymore. He said we.
Before we go on, I would like to just dwell on this point a little bit. The fact that how significant is it? First of all, Donald Trump is extremely unpopular, and this is putting it mildly, with a massive segment of the American populace. Now, Barack Obama was prosecuting this war even with, say, the enjoying the support of, say, a lot of the population that would tend to be.
Yeah, I think it was 60% of the American population when Mr. Obama came in approved of the Afghan war. Now that's half of the American population still believes in it.
What's interesting is that he was trying to do, and I'd like to just talk about, well, how different this really is, what Donald Trump is proposing here from that of his predecessor. But to talk about, and as he addressed, the fact that there is such a large segment of the American population that basically says, we don't want anything to do with it. It's past time that we got out of there. A lot of politicians, including Donald Trump, have been making the promise that we weren't going to stay there. So he's really up against a pretty high mountain of public opposition to this idea. How much does that affect the way that he may be able to actually carry out what he's proposing here?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like he is looking at this in a way where he's trying to weigh up the blood and the money already spent in Afghanistan and trying just not to leave and give it over to terrorists. That's what he said would happen. And he's right. I mean, if the United States left tomorrow, the country, just like we saw in Iraq, there would be Al-Qaeda, Islamic State. He mentioned that the nation with the most terrorist groups that are on the United States list of terrorist groups is Afghanistan. So that nation would quickly descend further into being a terrorist hub if we up and left.
It's,
and so he's trying to
defeat. Conceding defeat to the forces that we've worked so hard to take down over this time.
Right. So he has to look at it, and it is rock and a hard place with Afghanistan completely. The generals, it seems, back this plan. It looks like there will be a troop increase of about 4,000 men. This is something that Mr. Trump gave the authority to Defense Secretary Mattis months ago, that he could increase it. And Mattis said, I don't want to increase it until we have a strategy. So this is the strategy. Again, we're trying to just back back our forces with about 12,000 men max, try and take out the terrorist groups. We're also calling on Pakistan to no longer harbor terrorist groups and try and he really wants Pakistan to stop supporting the Taliban because Pakistan has been a thorn in the United States fight. In the side of the United States fight in Afghanistan as well. There was also the big difference, I would say, between this and what Mr. Obama wants in Afghanistan was that it will no longer, he was very clear that the United States will no longer tell anybody when they're necessarily increasing troops, when they want to get out. This mission isn't time sensitive. We're not going to announce to our foes that we're only there for 2 years, so wait it out. Which is it seems to be a logical strategy to have, to not tell your enemy what you're planning. But nevertheless, is 12,000 men enough to root the terrorists out of Afghanistan, to try and leave some type of exit strategy for the United States where it's not ashamed or doesn't look at the loss of life in Afghanistan as lives lost in vain? That's yet to be seen.
You know, it seems to me like you brought out the fact that the one big change that we see between Donald Trump's policy and that of Barack Obama is this lack of a deadline and not telegraphing our moves too far in advance. And yet, if you look at it from the standpoint of the terrorists, it would be difficult for them not to basically see this as exactly the same situation that they were in before, from the standpoint that America is not there to stay. If you look at the situation, and Donald Trump said that in his speech, basically he said, we cannot remain a force for peace in the world if we are not at peace with each other. And the fact is, we're not at peace with each other. The amount of division within the United States is a tremendously high right now. And it's a point that Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has brought up many times, that a house divided against itself cannot stand. They would have to view this as, okay, well, maybe he hasn't given us a deadline, but still, they're not here indefinitely. And if we do just bunker down and if we do, you know, basically commit to the long game, eventually the country is ours. At some point, the United States has to leave. And then, you know, even if we have to delay our goals for the time being, you know, we eventually will have an opportunity to come back out.
Yeah, it looks like that. I mean, you are limited by the American style of government, where you have this. Yes, we have incredible division inside of the country, and that does not give a leader strength to act in a decisive military fashion, in a decisive way militarily, and that's hampering him. Also, the fact, as you said, I mean, the United States. Stomach for war, especially this war, has gone. I mean, nobody wants to be a part of this war. I would say right now we're in it. So that's why we need to try and figure out a way, or the United States needs to try and figure out a way to get out by saving face and justifying the lives that were lost. But it's very, very hard to do that. It's very hard to do that because you have other powers right now, not just in Afghanistan, but you could talk about Russia, you could talk about Iran. We've talked about both of those on this show over the past couple of months, of them infiltrating Afghanistan to try and perpetuate the problem. They want to bleed the United States. Iran does, Russia does, and they are going to make this as difficult as possible for the United States to get out of Afghanistan.
So I'd like to go back and just look at when the United States first went to war in Afghanistan, at the very beginning. 9/11 happened. The United States responded very forcefully. Afghanistan was the first target, and it was the first theater that the United States got involved in an effort to confront the terrorists that perpetrated that act on American soil. From the very beginning, what was the Trumpet's analysis, looking at the situation from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, the prophecies that Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury pointed to and basically saying this is going to be the outcome And where are we with respect to those prophecies today?
Right. So ever since 2001, Mr. Flory has looked at a couple of prophecies, especially in the book of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, the blessings and cursings chapters, which basically say to end time Israel, or any nation really, but specifically to Israel, that there are laws that you need to obey. And if you don't obey those laws, I will bring curses upon you. And there's some specific curses that we're seeing play out here. And one of those being in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 18, it says that God's going to punish Israel for their sins and that he will break the pride of your power. You're going to have power. No one denies that the United States has a lot of power, but there is a broken will there to use it effectively. And in 2003, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory wrote an article in the Trumpet magazine, so we're going back 14 years, and that the title of that article was "Why We Cannot Win the War Against Terrorism." That's why we're in Afghanistan, right? The war against terrorism, taking the fight to the terrorists. That's where the 9/11 that's where those attacks were planned from. Partly, that's where Osama bin Laden was held out. Al Qaeda was held out. That was the war against terrorism. And here we are 17 years later. That war has not only not been won, it looks even more further. Oh, it looks further away from being won because of both the sins of the United States and the failure to use their power effectively. Mr. Flory in this article talks about how while Afghanistan might have been a reasonable target in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the real state sponsors of terrorism, such as the biggest ones, such as Iran, the United States did not have the will to go after the biggest state sponsor of terrorism. And now we see Iran's fingerprints in Afghanistan perpetuating this war as well, which is just a direct fulfillment of that forecast 14 years ago.
Yeah, excellent point. And I really think, just looking at that passage in Leviticus, that statement that your strength will be spent in vain, I just don't think that there's anywhere in the world where you see more direct fulfillment of that prophecy than what we have expended within Afghanistan. Of course, Iraq as well, but Afghanistan going on even longer. And at this point, we're talking about ramping up our involvement there. And when you don't see victory in sight, even as strong as President Trump's pronouncements are that we're going to finish this thing, we're going to have victory, when you look at the facts on the ground, when you look at the overall situation that we're up against, and you see it in terms of the prophecies, and Herbert Armstrong talking about World War II being the last war that America will have won, and we know that it's prophesied to go down, you see we've got some ugly times ahead, and it is just going to be more strength spent in vain. So really extraordinary fulfillment of prophecy there. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the Trump administration's new policy in Afghanistan. You know, watch that situation and just see if these prophecies don't come to even greater clarity in their fulfillment. And keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for more updates on the situation. Brent, thanks for the analysis. Thanks for sharing your time with us.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Is the Bible just a collection of myths and legends? One of the most well-known stories in the Bible is the Tower of Babel. This is a few generations after the Great Flood. People gathered in Babel. They built a tower that was meant to reach unto heaven, and God put their construction project to a stop by confounding the languages of the workers so that they all dispersed. You can read that in Genesis chapter 11. Well, there is actually evidence that it's not just a story in the Bible. There are a lot of accounts of this same history that demonstrate that this was an actual event that a lot of people experienced and that they recalled in later years. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Chris Eames with us. Hello, Chris.
Pleasure to be here. Hello.
So we talked before about the flood, this earth-wide deluge that basically affected all of mankind, and the fact that you have accounts of the flood in other cultures that kind of underline and give support to the idea that the Bible is actually accurate in this history. Maybe you could just summarize what we talked about in that previous interview.
Certainly, yes. The Great Flood was my original article, like you say, and I covered some of the unique artifacts that have been found corroborating the story, the biblical account of the Great Flood. There's several artifacts within the Middle East that have been found, ancient documents referring to specific details of the Great Flood, even the fact that the animals went in two by two, amazing little details like that. But not only within the Middle East accounts were these preserved, but also across civilization. And like you say, that's exactly what we should expect. If all humanity did in fact come from Noah and his family and the flood, then we should expect those traditions to be preserved through the people that would come through them. And so not only do we find these stories preserved throughout the Middle East, throughout ancient things like the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Epic of Atrahasis, but we find them throughout China. We find them throughout Latin America, Latin and South America. We find them in Hindu legends. We find them in Scandinavia, all across the world. Really interesting, and in many cases, very detailed accounts that match up quite strikingly with the biblical description of the Great Flood. So my Tower of Babel article really follows along those same lines and that same logic.
So yeah, if you take the Bible account literally, essentially, this was the genesis of the variety, the multiplicity of languages that we have on the earth today. So if all of these different cultures experienced this common occurrence that the earth was united in language, they tried to build this tower, and then the dispersing of language or the varying of the languages is what caused the people to disperse and to spread out from there. You're saying that there is actually evidence from other cultures that they experienced the same thing and that they have a common memory of that event.
Exactly. And the amount of legends, of similar stories is actually just mind-blowing. Just going through this process of writing the article myself was quite remarkable for me, just to research just the amount of stories and the stories themselves, how detailed they are recording these parallel events, but also the amount of stories throughout different cultures is really surprising and inspiring, really.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these accounts that demonstrate that this isn't something that's limited only to the biblical record.
Okay. Well, we'll start out with the most ancient one that has been found thus far, and it was an epic, ancient story, tablet story that was discovered in the city of Sumer, and this dates to around 2100 BC, so that's more than 4,000 years old, this tablet, and this would have placed it right after the actual occurrence of the flood and right around the time of the building of the Tower of Babel, as the Bible describes. So if this indeed does link up, which we'll go through the text and how it does, then that's essentially an eyewitness account, really, of what the Bible is talking about. But this epic, this inscription here, discusses the building of a tower. It talks about the ruler who is wishing for an incantation to be made, enchantments to be made, so that all the different languages that are being spoken can return as they were to being one language. So you have this remarkable story here. In the process of a tower being built, you had people speaking one language. Somewhere along the line, that got confused. The inscription actually says that the Lord of Abundance shall change the speech in their mouths, and you have this desire to recite these incantations to return the speech as one, so that people can continue to serve each other in a more harmonious manner.
Now, what's interesting about the ruler talked about in this inscription is he has been linked to perhaps being Nimrod himself. Enmerkar is the name, and the ending there, kar, means hunter in the original language, and we know Nimrod was Nimrod the hunter from the Bible. And even looking at the critical consonants of the name preceding kar, Enmerkar, they line up pretty well with Nimrod's name. You've got the N, the M, and the R. So there's a possible link there to this actually perhaps being Nimrod the hunter himself in this inscription.
So yeah, in the biblical account, it's in Genesis 10 where it talks about Nimrod being a mighty hunter before the Eternal. And he was very instrumental in the construction of the Tower of Babel in the biblical account. So this suggests a pretty close link between those two.
Right, and the place where this all occurred, Babel, in Babylon, this area, this general area, has been discovered through archaeology as well, under its native name, Babili. It is a well-known archaeological site. And as an interesting point, some scientists believe that the Tower of Babel was designed like a ziggurat. Now, these are really wide, mountainous-style temple structures, kind of square temples with zigzagging staircases. And many of these have been found throughout the Middle East and even going back to this very time period. So you can see that on the article, a depiction of that. It is it gives a little insight into what the Tower of Babel may have looked like, and it also helps corroborate what Josephus said about the Tower of Babel. He mentioned how mountainous in width it was, rather than being like we think of a tower, a narrow, slender, tall thing. Mm-hmm. So like a ziggurat, would have been in that time period, it was quite a wide mountainous building. And now this Sumerian account isn't the only ancient account that we do have. We've found an Assyrian inscription dating to about the 8th to 7th centuries BC. This is a really remarkable inscription as well, just with the detail that it goes into. And I just wanted to read a couple of sentences from this inscription. It says, of Babylon he hastens to the submission, talking of their god. Small and great he confounded on the mound, or tower. Their walls all the day he founded for their destruction in the night. He did not leave a remainder. In his anger he also, his secret counsel he pours out. To confound their speeches, he set his face. He gave the command, he made strange their counsel. So the parallels there are just jumping out of the page, essentially, for you there. The God in this text confounding the speeches of these people who are putting together this tower. This from an ancient Assyrian inscription. And actually, if you look at the original word they used, the Assyrians, for confound, that is the equivalent word to what we read in Genesis 11, Balel, meaning to confuse. So the parallels between this Assyrian inscription and the Sumerian one are really quite remarkable. And those ones are just from the Middle East area itself.
And did you say that this Assyrian document that you're talking about, that that's actually in the British Museum?
So I'm not sure if this is on display for people who are visiting, but it's at least within the British archives there in the museum.
So two pretty convincing accounts from two different cultures, geographically distant from one another. Are there others that we can look at that further verify the biblical account?
There are. Like we were talking about, we should expect these things to be spread across the entire globe, really. If all of this happened before that great dispersion of people, as the Bible says, we should find it everywhere. So as I continue to go through in my article, you can read that online if you like. There's stories, for example, in the Americas that have been found. There's an ancient Aztec tradition of a giant who was saved from a great flood and then began building a pyramid to reach the clouds. This project was destroyed by the gods, according to their tradition, and suddenly the builders of this pyramid begin speaking in all these different languages. So there you have a tower, a confusion of languages, and a flood, kind of all in the same general time frame here. And that's another thing I noticed with these accounts, is oftentimes they're linked with a flood as having happened directly after a flood.
Right, which makes sense. I guess the way that it's spelled out in the Bible, the flood happened, and then this was essentially man's response to that, to try to build something that would be able to withstand a future deluge of similar proportions where it reached high enough that they would be safe from the waters of the flood.
Right. And we get that understanding from reading the biblical account, but also Josephus provides a lot of additional material for that. He talks about the Tower of Babel having been specially made and designed to withstand water seeping into it. It was designed so that Nimrod essentially could get back at God for having sent the flood in the first place. So this was very much a response to the flood. And we see that connection with the flood through several of these stories.
That's really remarkable. So beyond the Americas, maybe just quickly, you could say where else that similar accounts have been discovered?
Sure. Well, there's an Armenian traditional account that talks of giants building a high tower that was blown down by the wrath of God, and within those winds were carried unknown words to spread confusion between the builders. There's a Hindu tradition for the Indians of a tall, proud tree that was supposed to reach heaven, but God cut off the branches, or Brahma, their god in this case, cut off the branches, dispersed them, and from those branches, different languages emerged. So you've got a little link there. That you've got Polynesian legends, like the story of Rata and his three sons surviving a great flood. If that doesn't link to Noah and his three sons, I don't know what does. But they attempt to build a tower after this flood to see the Creator God. And their God, in this case, chased the builders away, destroyed the tower, and caused them to speak in various tongues. There's traditions very similar from Burma, from Korea, Mexico, Kenya, Estonia, Guatemala, Greece, Alaska. The list just keeps going on. So it's amazing just the volume of these traditions that are being discovered, being learnt about, that add to not just the Middle Eastern traditions. It isn't just an Israeli tradition. It isn't just a Middle Eastern tradition, even though we do find it with the Sumerians, Assyrians, Chaldeans, Syrophoenicians. They all have their own versions of this tradition. Mm-hmm. But it's not just a Middle Eastern tradition. It does spread right across the world, all corners of the earth. You can find this.
So the logic is that if all of these people have a similar idea, that they had a similar experience, that all of these different accounts are, in fact, single, they're various accounts of the same event, it makes a lot of sense. We've been talking with trumpet writer Chris Eames about the biblical account of the Tower of Babel and just how much you find the same account in other cultures and other accounts worldwide. He has an article that he's written that is published on watchjerusalem.com. Watchjerusalem.com, the title of the article, The Tower of Babel, Just a Bible Story. I'd encourage you to go there. It's a fantastic website. It really focuses on events that are happening within this most biblically prophetic city in the world. But the website also has a lot of information about archaeology, like the one that we're talking about here, other aspects of biblical history. Plenty of interest there to go check out, watchjerusalem.com. I'd really encourage you to do that. And Chris, thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Some years ago, I spent a day at my oldest daughter's elementary school, and I learned a lot about human nature. This school operates a program that invites students' fathers to be on campus throughout the day, serving as an extra pair of eyes, scoping the halls for potential threats, an extra set of hands helping in the classrooms. It's a great program. I witnessed some pretty impressive things in some of the classrooms. One teacher had her fourth graders breaking down sentences grammatically with jaw-dropping precision. As a group, they were reciting rules about semantic gradability and inflectional morphology, whatever those are. I'm trying to figure out how inexpensive it would be to hire myself a 9-year-old grammar tutor. In other classrooms, however, far less learning was going on. As teachers instructed, private conversations bubbled. Practically any distraction derailed students from the task at hand. Students spoke out, apparently, whenever thoughts popped into their heads, even rude ones. I'm no expert in elementary education, but I think I can distill the difference between the fruitful and the unfruitful classrooms down to one single factor: the teacher's determination to confront bad behavior. You put a bunch of kids together, and you're bound to see some bad behavior. It may start small, but if it isn't confronted, it spreads. A child talks while the teacher is instructing. If nothing happens, the next kid thinks, huh, I guess it's okay to do that. So he talks too. Some other kid thinks, well, if he can do that, then I'll do this. And in no time, the room sounds like Grand Central Station. Sometimes I think children are hardwired to continue getting louder until someone tells them enough. The truth is, they're getting louder specifically to test how long it takes before someone tells them enough. The teacher with the fortitude to truly confront the problem can quickly transform the unruliness into ruliness. Dr. Albert Siegel once wrote, "When it comes to rearing children, every society is only 20 years away from barbarism. 20 years is all we have to accomplish the task of civilizing the infants who are born into our midst each year. These savages know nothing of our language, our culture, our religion, our values, our customs of interpersonal relations. The barbarian must be tamed if civilization is to survive." Well, that's a bit dramatic, but in a sense, it is painfully true. Calling children savages certainly reflects reality far better than treating them like natural-born saints or sages or savants. Our human nature represents a savage within each of us that must be civilized, and children have it in spades unless we are diligent in confronting it. That's why Proverbs 29:15 says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings his mother to shame." Where this reality truly smacked me in the face was on the playground at my daughter's school. I spent 3 recesses outside with first graders, then second graders, then fifth graders. Each successive mob was worst behaved. The fifth graders, having lived more years without being properly civilized, were genuine specimens of savagery. Everywhere I turned, I saw carnality on parade: name-calling, accusing, cursing, screaming, boasting, pushing, sulking, cheating. I realized that most of these same kids had just been inside under the authority of effective, qualified teachers who had managed to keep a lid on all this ugliness through productive, focused work. The level of human nature suddenly on display correlated precisely with the lack of government in their lives at that moment. Take a good student out of the structure of a disciplined classroom and turn him loose with 60 other kids and virtually no supervision, and you have Lord of the Flies. I've noticed the same dynamic at work in my own home. Every time my family gets overly busy, and I in particular begin letting events overtake us, the savages begin their parade. If my wife and I aren't really paying attention, it gets louder and uglier until it's too obvious to ignore, and we step in with a firm enough. That's not the way God intended family to be. Yet it may not be exaggerating to say that this form of child training, this ignore the barbarians until they drive you mad, it's probably the number one method employed in the Western world today. I'm still trying to figure out how elementary school educators believe that allowing children a half hour of barbarism on the playground to break up the day helps round them out. There's much to be said for maintaining a steady presence of civilizing forces in our children's lives. Activities, instruction, discipline, reading, games, work, chores, crafts, charts, schedules, rewards, punishments, supervision. Kids crave structure. When it isn't there, they act out until they get it. And when they get it, it frees them up to achieve some amazing things. Now, don't get me wrong, family isn't boot camp. It doesn't necessarily take enormous effort to steer clear of pandemonium in favor of structured or even lightly supervised play. And it's not that children shouldn't be given enough room to make mistakes. We don't want to get in a negative cycle of criticizing them for every word or deed that proves that they are what they are, little people who aren't yet civilized. We need to make sure the overall message we're sending is a positive one. When we do things decently and in order, the way God does, life is happier, it's more fun, it's more rewarding in every way. As our children grow, the responsibility for structuring their lives and bridling themselves must gradually shift onto their own shoulders. They need to practice at civilizing the savage within. Otherwise, the moment they're on their own, they're going to turn into big versions of the fifth graders on that playground. And if you want to know what that looks like, visit an American university. The task of civilizing the infants born into our midst is crucial, and it is great. 20 years is all we have. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Chris Eames. Thanks to our staff, Richard Palmer and Dwight Falk. I'll leave you with this thought from William Hazlitt. Simplicity of character is the natural result of profound thought. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.